I'm VOA's Jeff Custer with this worldwide news update. French President Emmanuel Macron called leaders from key European nations and Britain to Paris Monday for an emergency meeting on how to deal with the U.S., once a rock-solid partner. More from VOA's Tommy McNeil.
The move follows a week-long diplomatic blitz on Ukraine by the Trump administration that seemed to embrace the Kremlin while it cold-shouldered many of its age-old European allies. A flurry of speeches by U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth during their initial visits to Europe last week questioned both Europe's security commitments and its fundamental democratic principles. Macron said their stinging rebukes and threats of non-cooperation in the face of military danger felt like a shock to the system. The tipping point came when Trump decided to upend years of U.S. policy by holding talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin in hopes of ending the Russia-Ukraine war. Then Trump's special envoy for Ukraine and Russia on Saturday all but ruled out the inclusion of other Europeans in any Ukraine peace talks. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
The Kremlin reports Monday Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov and other Russian officials will meet in Saudi Arabia with their U.S. counterparts for talks on restoring ties and preparing a meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Donald Trump. VOA's Richard Green reports.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that Lavrov and Putin's foreign affairs advisor Yuri Yushchenkov will fly to the Saudi capital later Monday. The U.S. delegation will be led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, along with Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron is set to host a group of European leaders for talks Monday amid a shift in the U.S. approach to the war. The United States has been Ukraine's biggest arms supplier during the conflict, but Trump has wavered on continued support. Richard Green, VOA News.
This is VOA News. An Israeli drone strike in the southern Lebanon port city of Sidon has killed one person, Associated Press correspondent Lawrence Brooks reports.
Lebanese state media says it's the deepest strike in the country since a ceasefire between Hezbollah and Israel took effect in late November. The identity of the victim is not immediately clear. The strike occurred near a Lebanese army checkpoint and Sidon's municipal sports stadium. The strike comes a day before the deadline for Israel's full withdrawal from southern Lebanon under the ceasefire agreement that's ended the 14-month war between Israel and Hezbollah. Since the ceasefire, Israel has continued airstrikes in southern and eastern Lebanon, saying it's targeting military sites containing missiles and combat equipment. Israel and Lebanon have exchanged accusations of violating the ceasefire agreement. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
The Israeli military later reported the drone strike killed Mohammed Shaheen, the head of Hamas Operations Department in Lebanon. The army accused Shaheen of recently planning terror attacks directed and funded by Iran. Witnesses report Rwandan-backed M23 rebels have advanced Sunday into the center of Bukavu, an Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, meeting little resistance from government troops. Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reports.
On Sunday in Bukavu, there was little sign of the clashes and bloodshed that preceded Goma's capture, and people there said they had seen M23 troops passing unopposed through central districts since the early morning. Some even took selfies with the rebels and welcomed them with cheers and applause. Video verified by Reuters shows M23 fighters posing for photos in the provincial capital's central Independence Square. While the situation appeared largely calm, more verified footage showed smoke rising from Bukavu Central Prison. The Democratic Republic of Congo's government confirmed rebels were in Bukavu and also accused Rwandan troops of entering the city. However, it stopped short of saying the city was fully under M23's control.
That was Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reporting. At least 9 people have died in the most recent round of severe weather to hit the U.S., including 8 people in the southern U.S. state of Kentucky who died as creeks swelled from heavy rain and water-covered roads. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear says many of the deaths in his state from the storms, including a mother and her 7-year-old child swept away in their car by floodwater, were caused by vehicles getting stuck in high water.
Avoid driving through covered roadways. That's where we're losing the most people.
Much of the U.S. is facing another round of biting weather, says National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Orovec.
There's still some big winter weather impact.
The northern plains facing life-threatening cold. Tornado watches issued for parts of Georgia and Florida, while snow and sleet remain in the forecast for the Northeast. I'm Julie Walker.
That wraps up this news update, but the world and the news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So one, on the economic front, China remains the continent's most important trade partner. China is also the most important source of infrastructure funding, and not just funding, but also capacity, to build infrastructure and so on. China has stepped into that.
That was Paul Manatulia, an associate researcher at Africa Center for Strategic Studies on China trying to consolidate its political objectives in Africa. Details coming up. Also, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has echoed President Trump's vision for a Gaza free from the influence of Hamas. And a Nigerian army jet killed at least six civilians after mistakenly attacking them while pursuing gangs. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Panic has gripped the city of Bukavu as M23 fighters entered the outskirts of Eastern Congo's second largest city, which is home to about 1.3 million people, some 101 kilometers south of rebel-held Goma. I asked reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Kattani in Goma to brief us on the latest.
Yes, so now the city of Bukavu is under control, even if some panic, because, you know, people can be under panic, but the city is totally in the control of M23. And in difference with the city of Goma, they were not fighting in Bukavu, because a day before M23 getting in Bukavu, FRC had already moved, and this was something which helps population to do not lose their life. You know, Goma had accounts more than 3,000 people were killed because of the intense fighting in the city, but Bukavu didn't have fighting.
So because there was no fighting in Bukavu, the death toll was not as immense as it was in Goma.
Exactly. Goma had more than 20,000 soldiers and was a leader here. But Bukavu had not all of those. So when FRDC left the city and also was a land left to, then M23 took the city without many assaults than how it was in Goma.
Okay, so Bukavu it's a city about 1.3 million people, and it lies about 101 kilometers south of rebel-held Goma. So my question for you is, are there any reports of looting and disorder after the M23 advance came into Bukavu?
Exactly, looting. Exactly. Looting has become a Congolese culture. When fleeing, FRDC were looting population, but also after the rebels took the control of the city of Bukavu, we saw people, citizens of Bukavu, also looting shops, warehouses, supermarkets, and people were taking anything they can take. And this became like normal, and rebels was not forbidding people to do so. Bukavu is also loaded at the same level than Goma. Can say today that Bukavu doesn't have any shop or supermarket which have not been loaded, and the disorder is still ongoing, not only in Bukavu, but now also in the city of Uvira.
And Jafar, you know, the conflict was among the top agenda items at the African Union summit in Ethiopia on Saturday, where UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned it risked spiraling into a regional conflagration. African leaders are worried the conflict could spread.
Exactly, because we are seeing many actors are trying to be involved in this conflict. But now it's not only Rwanda who is pointing, but also Uganda and at some scale occurring to commonly observed Kenya too. And on the government side, the government has also some allies such as Burundi, which is fighting alongside Burundi, fighting alongside FRDC. Officially, we had also a SAMI DRC, a SADC mission in DRC, including Tanzanian, South African, and Malawian. And for now, we are also hearing from some sources in DRC that Angola and Chad can also join the government of DRC in fighting. And this is what shows that this conflict can change by becoming a regional conflict and not a conflict between Congo and Rwanda.
Reporter Sabiti Jafar Alketanti, he spoke to me from Goma. U.S. Secretary of State Mark Rubio says Hamas must be eradicated. He spoke alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as he echoed President Donald Trump's vision for a Gaza free from the influence of Hamas. VOA's Arash Arbasadi has more.
Three male hostages taken by Hamas returned to Israel after more than 15 months of captivity. The hostage release is part of a fragile ceasefire deal with Israel in which both parties agreed to lay down arms during hostage and prisoner swaps. Among those freed by Hamas was dual U.S.-Israeli national Sagi Dekochen. He reunited with his wife, who hid in a safe room with their two daughters during the October 7, 2023 attacks, in which Hamas took some 250 people hostage. The freed hostages arrived at a hospital as U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio began a regional tour of the Middle East.
Hamas cannot continue as a military or government force. And frankly, as long as it stands as a force that can govern or as a force that can administer or as a force that can threaten by use of violence, peace becomes impossible. They must be eliminated. It must be eradicated.
As hostages saw their families and received medical care, both Rubio and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke of unity against Iran's regional influence.
Today, Secretary Rubio and I had a very productive discussion with our staffs on a number of issues. None of them are more important than Iran. Israel and America stand shoulder to shoulder in countering the threat of Iran. We agreed that the Ayatollahs must not have nuclear weapons. And we also agree that Iran's aggression in the region has to be rolled back.
As part of the hostage deal, Israel released 369 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. 36 were serving life sentences. Israel calls these people terrorists. Palestinians call them freedom fighters. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump continued his push last week for the United States to seize control of Gaza and develop it.
We're going to have it, and we're going to keep it, and we're going to make sure that there's going to be peace, and there's not going to be any problem, and nobody's going to question it, and we're going to run it very properly, and eventually we'll have economic development at a very large scale, maybe the largest scale on that site.
Israeli military offensives flattened much of Gaza since the war with Hamas began. Israel says it targets terrorists. Palestinians call the strikes indiscriminate. Trump says he'd like to see regional actors like Egypt and Jordan take in the roughly 2.3 million Palestinians displaced from fighting. This is something neither government seems inclined to do. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
Chinese naval flotillas have been deployed continuously off Africa since 2008. They started as anti-piracy missions and gradually incorporated sea and land-based exercises, naval port calls, and protecting sea lanes. Experts say China's expanding military education is designed to cultivate personal, professional, and political ties, as well as promote China's governance models. Paul Nanatulia, an associate researcher at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explains to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi why the initiatives in Africa have raised concerns among pro-democracy advocates.
You know, Mohamed, Democracy promotion is risky business in Africa. We have seen every time you have an election and, you know, you have an incumbent that does not want to leave office for one reason or other, the cavalry is rolled out on the streets. Infantry, fighting vehicles, police cannon is deployed. Soldiers are deployed. Intelligence operatives are deployed against opposition leaders, against civil society. There's constantly clashes between pro-democracy, civil society, human rights organizations and individuals and promoters and the security services. This is just a problem that is frankly gotten worse on the African continent. So African stakeholders, especially those that are interested in promoting democratic standards, promoting standards of good governance and so on, are very, very sensitive and very mindful of where their officers train, because these security professionals, these security institutions are deployed against them on the street. So they want to take an interest. Who's training these forces? What is the content of that training? So when you look at the discourse, you examine the discourse within pro-democracy constituencies in Africa, they tend to have a guarded view when it comes to Chinese military education. And that is because there is a perception of the continent. Certainly, you know, China is a one-party state. If you look at Afrobarometer reports, over 70% of African respondents polled across 44 African countries reject one-party rule. 74% reject military rule. About 75% demand for genuine, authentic democracy as the best way to govern and manage a society. So that's the reason why pro-democracy constituencies tend to be very, very guarded and tend to take a very dim view of Chinese military education.
What is China doing to consolidate its political objectives in Africa?
China is doing quite a bit. So one, on the economic front, China remains the continent's most important trade partner. China is also the most important source of infrastructure funding, and not just funding, but also capacity, you know, to build infrastructure and so on. China has stepped into that, and this was not the case before. You know, there has been a trend of Chinese state-owned enterprises increasingly stepped up their activities in sectors where traditional Western firms are not as engaged as they were even 5 or even 10 years ago. So China becomes important from that perspective. So economic leverage, using economic levers. China also invests heavily in media. China is an important media player on the continent with a media architecture that is growing and which is designed, to use the words of Xi Jinping, to tell China's story well, to advance Chinese narratives, to advance Chinese conceptions of international order, of international relations, and so on. So media becomes an extremely important vehicle. The other vehicle is a professional training. Now, China is currently educating more African students than any other industrialized country besides France. And given how popular foreign international education is on the African continent, you know, the Chinese government has understood that this is one way in which China can increase its soft power influence and can promote a positive image of itself on the African continent. And then the other elements, security, providing training for all these forces and all the different activities that Chinese firms are doing on the continent provide China with a means to generate that influence, that diplomatic influence that it needs. And indeed, we see it in African countries behavior at the United Nations. Rarely do you ever get an African country that will vote against the People's Republic of China on a particular issue, whether it's Taiwan or Tibet or Xinjiang or any other issue, the national security law in Hong Kong. African countries always vote traditionally alongside the People's Republic of China. So all this to say that China has an array of instruments at its disposal to build and to strengthen and to expand its influence on the African continent.
That was Paul Nanatulia, an associate researcher at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Elshenawy. An army jet killed at least 6 civilians after mistakenly attacking them while pursuing gangs in northern Nigeria's Katsina state. 3 residents told the French news agency AFP that the plane dropped a bomb on a cluster of huts on the outskirts of Zaka village in Safana district on Saturday. Amnesty International put the number of dead at 10. They added that the strike came after bandits attacked a police base in the village, killing 2 policemen and vigilante assisting them. The military did not respond to an AFP request for comment. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is 1-202-258-3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Uganda's government said Sunday it would drop a military trial against opposition figurehead Kizza Besigye, urging him to give up his hunger strike in jail. Cabinet spokesman and information minister Chris Barrio-Munsi told the French news agency AFP that the government is fast-tracking the transfer of Besigye's case from the court-martial to the civil court. The Supreme Court has ruled that a military trial is unconstitutional. The government's pledge was promptly rejected as suspicious by Besigye's wife, UNAIDS executive director Winnie Byanyama. She told the media that she would hold the government responsible for whatever happens to him. Besigye, a former ally turned rival of longtime President Yoweri Museveni, went on hunger strike on February 10th in protest at his detention. The South African government remains resolute after the Trump administration threatened to cut funding over a new land reform act to address racial disparities in land ownership. Despite three decades since apartheid, most farmland is still owned by white people. The government faces pressure to implement the reforms, though critics argue they should proceed cautiously. For more perspective on the Land Reform Act, VOA's Paul Indiho spoke with Ricky Mukonza, a political analyst and professor at Tshwane University of Technology in South Africa.
The land question is a historical and emotive question across Africa. And South Africa is no exception. We know the history of South Africa, where colonialism and apartheid started in a situation where the black majority in the country were, you know, dispossessed of land and were forced to live, you know, in certain, you know, conditions. And when 1994 came, when South Africa got its independence, not much changed. And the land question has been on the table for quite some time now. The unequal distribution of land has been an issue that you know, has dominated academia, dominated the public spaces. It's something that people have been talking about. In one way or the other, land had to be distributed. And the situation cannot continue as it has been before 94, and it cannot continue as it is now. There is need for some, you know, equitable redistribution of land.
How about for those people who argue that this issue of land could lead South Africa to where Zimbabwe was a couple years ago, where the former late President Robert Mugabe decided to, you know, to do a 360 on the land issue and decided to let people take over white farms and what, and it ended up resulting into a catastrophic scenario for Zimbabwe. Would the same scenario apply here, or there are two different methods and people are looking at it differently?
I think there are two different scenarios that are here, Paul, in the sense that the South African leaders seem to be proactive. You would know that in Zimbabwe it became what is now known as the fast track land reform program, which was characterized by the use of force and the use of violence. In this case, we have not seen that. And I don't think President Ramaphosa will allow the situation to descend into what we saw in Zimbabwe. One thing that must be emphasized, Paul, is that the land question is not only about what government does. It's a societal matter that must be dealt with. I don't see South Africa going the Zimbabwean route, but if all parties do not play their roles as envisaged in the act, then we may have a challenge in the sense that the masses or the majority black people may decide to take the law into their own hands.
Ricky Mokonza, political analyst and professor at Shweni University of Technology in South Africa. He spoke with VOA's Pauline Diho. Since June 2024, when a series of mass protests took place in Kenya, 82 cases of alleged forced disappearances have been recorded, according to the Kenyan National Human Rights Commission. It's yet to be confirmed who is behind the abductions. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo, who spoke to two brothers who say they were abducted for 32 days.
It's here in the Kitengela town neighborhood, about an hour away from central Nairobi, that Aslam Longton and his brother Jamil say they were abducted. Earlier that day in August, Aslam says he felt uneasy and noticed unfamiliar people were watching him. The brothers were riding together by car when things unraveled.
That first corner, there was a Toyota Vixt parked there. Opened the old doors, so I cannot pass there. So I reversed the car. I come this place. When I entered this place, there was a Subaru come and blocked me here. And Toyota Axio blocked me at behind of there.
The brothers alleged they were approached by heavily armed men they described as appearing to be police officers and asked to switch off their car. Once again, here is Aslam.
They opened the car, removed me at the steering, took me very fast to the Subaru.
Jamil Longton says he was not meant to be taken away that day, but when he pressed the officers, even suggesting to call the neighborhood's police station, they refused to introduce themselves.
I kept on asking them, who are you? Where are you taking my brother? I told them, I'll call the OCS Kitengela police station to ask him if he's aware of whatever you're doing. When I attempted to call the OCS, my phone was confiscated by them. I was slapped, my phone switched off, and was also bungled into the Subaru.
The brothers say they were handcuffed, blindfolded, taken to a location, and held there for 32 days. Amnesty International and Kenya National Commission on Human Rights confirmed the accounts by the two men and say it's similar to the treatment of other abductees. KNHCR's Ernest Cornell.
Number one, they are telling us that they were denied food. They were kept in handcuffs for days. They were stripped naked and they were made to lie on concrete floors.
Aslam says he was taken due to his participation in the nationwide youth-led Gen Z protest last year against a proposed bill that would have increased taxes. The protest expanded into a call for an end to corruption and for the president to resign. The bill was eventually withdrawn. Aslam's brother didn't take part in the protest, but they say they were both repeatedly questioned about its funding source during their captivity. Rights groups accused the Kenyan police of using excessive force against protesters and in some cases abducting government critics. Police denied the allegations. The police also said that they had credible evidence criminal gangs had infiltrated the protests and planned to take advantage.
That was VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.